Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Streaming live from ScottHorton.org/listen. Next up is our friend Adam Morrow. He lives in Cairo and writes for Interpress Service. That's IPSnews.net. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
Good. Good, Scott. How are you today?
I'm doing real good. And here's Egyptian media silences protests. That's your last one. Co-author with Khaled Musa al-Amrani. I guess just go ahead and give us the bad news, man. Start off with the body count.
Body count today is indeterminate because things are still going on. Clashes are still going on all over the country, including several in Cairo, mainly in the Ramses Square area of Cairo, although I think that might have died down. It's very difficult to tell. As I mentioned in my article, there's kind of a news blackout. In terms of Egyptian media, at least, it's impossible to find out what's going on. The one station that you could quite reliably follow news with, local news with, was Gazeta. The one channel that was quite closely covering the all of the pro-Morsi demonstrations, and that's been scrambled. That's for the past couple of weeks. That's been scrambled intermittently, and then their live station has just gone off air tonight. I just turned on the television now and found I couldn't even find their live Egypt channel, which was devoted to 24-hour Egypt coverage. So that's gone. So it's becoming increasingly more difficult to tell what's happening. I mean, you've got the state television, which is all completely overnight has reverted back to its usual rhetoric, its usual Mubarak-era rhetoric about the Islamists and about the war on terrorism and that sort of thing. That's all in overdrive now, along with the private media, along with virtually all of Egypt's private media as well, which has also sort of jumped on board this military coup and is all entirely pro-army and entirely anti-Muslim Brotherhood and is pumping lies nonstop about the pro-Morsi demonstrations, saying that they're violent, saying that they're attacking people, saying all sorts of anything you can think of. The media is accusing these pro-Morsi demonstrations of. So it's very difficult. And all the Islamist channels and the Brotherhood channel, as I mentioned last time, all of those were closed within hours of Morsi's overthrow on July 3rd. So it's very difficult to tell exactly what's going on today. They did call the Muslim Brotherhood and allied Islamist parties and groups and figures did call for million man marches today all over the country. And I know they had big ones in Cairo, and I know they have lots of big ones in the provinces. But again, outside of Cairo, it's virtually impossible to tell what's going on or how big, you know, demonstration activity is, because there's virtually no news coverage of it. Now, all of this, bear in mind, has to be put within the context of what happened on Wednesday, mm-hmm. which is when you had 2 6-week-old sit-in protests violently dispersed by security forces. Since Morsi's overthrow on July 3rd, you had 2 big sit-ins in Cairo, one at Nahda Square and a larger one at Rabah al-Adawiyya Square, both of them in the capital. And both of those sites, which were drawing lots and lots of people on a regular basis. You'd have tens of thousands, if not more, if not even hundreds of thousands, sometimes coming to these sites every night for the past 7 weeks. Both of those sites were completely broken up, completely destroyed, reduced to rubble. The 2 big tent cities, 2 days ago on Wednesday, the security forces, after threatening for several days and weeks that they were going to break it up, finally went in. And it was just as bad as people thought it might, you know, it was, you know, sort of a worst case scenario. The health ministry is saying A couple hundred people were killed in those two sit-ins and the dispersal of those two sit-ins. But Brotherhood sources and Islamist sources and pro-Morsi sources say that the numbers of dead can be counted in the thousands, although they have been known to exaggerate casualties in the past. So it's difficult to, again, we're never going to know exactly how many people were killed, but we're looking at, we're looking at probably close to 1,000, if not more, people yesterday in Cairo alone. And then as well, there were also several clashes. There were often recurring incidences of pro-Morsi demonstrations being attacked by, these plainclothes thug types, who it's always impossible to tell definitively who they are, but presumably they're related to the security services. So it's been we've seen more deaths at this point in the last 48 or maybe 72 hours than we saw during the entire 18-day revolution in 2011. So it's to answer your question, yeah, it's bad. It's worse than it's ever been, and there's really no sign of any sort of negotiated solution at this point. I mean, all of the talk that we've heard in the last couple of weeks about, all this talk about civil war and the Algeria scenario and all of that stuff is unfortunately looking increasingly likely, just because cooler heads have not prevailed on either side. So the outlook is grim. Scott.
Man, all right, well. So the AP is saying it's at least 638 dead. And I think that's from maybe a day ago or so, but
the 638 number, I believe, is from Wednesday.
Right. Yes, that's what I was going to say. That's just from Wednesday. That doesn't include whoever died yesterday and today already, right? So it's got to be well over 1,000 now.
Oh yeah, from Wednesday. The last figures I was hearing were 60 dead in Ramsey Square, and that's just this afternoon. That's just one place this afternoon, as well as a couple of dozen killed in the city of Ismailia on the Suez Canal and in the Damiyat in the Nile Delta. You've also got stuff going on in Upper Egypt, which is the south. So again, it's I'd like to be able to give you more concrete stuff, but again, the media has been so complicit in everything that's happened over the last 6 to 7 weeks, that it's getting to the bottom of, the health ministry will come out with numbers and you absolutely can't, you can't believe anything they say at this point. I think one of the ministers came out yesterday, and I'm talking about ministers in the military-imposed, unelected government, mm-hmm. that replaced the elected government of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. One of these ministers just said yesterday that the police didn't use live fire when they broke up the sit-ins or something on Wednesday, when there's abundant evidence and loads of videos online that show that they did in fact use live fire to break up the protests. So, I mean, they're just lying through their teeth. So it's
Well, BBC ran, Adam, BBC ran footage of Cairo on fire. I mean, it was just incredible. Just the damage everywhere. I can't imagine.
That's the aftermath of the dispersals, right? That's what they, they literally destroyed these. Yeah, it's on fire. Like you said, it's like the entire ground is on fire. I mean, it's literally reduced to ash. And bear in mind, people had lived there for 6 or 7 weeks. People had really dug in there. They had created their own sort of systems of sanitation, and it was quite something. Especially the Rabaa al-Adawiyya one, the larger of the two, had kind of become something of an institution, almost like a kind of a mecca for a lot of people. And both sites were completely razed, and and we've got bodies that were burned. Apparently there are dozens, if not hundreds, of bodies that are burnt beyond recognition. I mean, we're just, a lot of this stuff is still coming out. You'll have an event, and then it won't be until the next couple of days that, all these videos come out, or like eyewitness testimonies start being heard. And so stuff is still coming out about this. There's some grim videos online that shows heavy sniper activity, which has been something that we've seen more and more of since January 25th. This phenomenon of snipers in rooftops just dropping people.
Yeah. Including,
very scary.
Yeah. There's footage, Justin Raimondo in his column today links to footage of, a guy trying to drag away a wounded guy, and then he gets sniped and shot down.
Shocking,
too.
Yeah.
And then the cover picture on antiwar.com today is a woman trying to hold off a bulldozer just with a hand. She's protecting a wounded man laying on the street. Is quite reminiscent of the famous Tiananmen Square picture of the
right.
solitary man
shocking.
Trying to face down the line of tanks.
Shocking stuff. Although I would just add, though, to that, that whenever people do look at these videos, that they have to be very careful about making sure that they are properly sourced and that they are now, presumably most of the stuff we're seeing is actually from Rabah al-Adawiyya Square. I'm not challenging that. But we have seen the appearance. There have been things cropping up where there'll be pictures of dead babies said to have been killed recently in Egypt, and then it'll turn out that the pictures were actually from Syria. You've actually had the same thing going on about stuff up the videos allegedly taken in Syria.
Right.
That it later turns out are actually from Iraq in like 2003. Like, so just that's my one warning I would sort of issue to your viewers. There's a lot of videos circulating these days, a lot of very emotionally charged, often very gruesome stuff floating around there with the express purpose of sort of getting people upset. Mm-hmm. And people just need to be careful that they're not being manipulated when they see these videos. You know, people just have to just double check and make sure that they're getting them from good sources, or that at least a good source can verify that this was actually taken in such and such a place at such and such a time.
Yeah.
We even had, and I'm saying that because there was actually one video that was very heavily circulated on social media sites in Egypt that supposedly showed a group of Islamists throwing a young boy from a roof. And actually, if you looked at it closely, it's very transparent that the whole thing was a hoax, hoax video that was just being put out there just in order to discredit the Islamists here. So I'm just saying, as an aside, people should be cautious because there's a lot of disinformation going on these days involving videos.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm sure that the Islamists are fighting back in ways that are probably, quite immoral in some cases, but that doesn't mean that it's okay what the government did, what the military has done in canceling the elections, overthrowing the elected government, not the massacres that they perpetrated on the people in the squares. Now, tell me this, among those who side with the Islamists, do people blame the United States for this?
The whole position on the United States here is a very intricate one, and it's kind of ironic. It's basically both sides, you know, the Islamist camp and then I think most accurately termed at this point, the fascist camp, quite frankly. Both of them are sort of vying with one another to outdo one another in their anti-Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each one sort of accuses the other of implementing an American agenda in the Middle East. You know, I mean, obviously you've got the military here is closely associated with the United States. And also you've had some interesting stuff concerning Israel and this reported drone attack in the Sinai Peninsula a couple of days ago, and talk in the Israeli press about close security coordination between Israel and the Egyptian military authorities. That came out 3 or 4 days ago, and that caused a big, big stir.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, basically it was good for the Islamist camp because they could point to the military and they say, look, this is who you're dealing with. I mean, you're dealing with people who are in bed with Israel and are closely coordinating their security in the Sinai Peninsula. And at the same time, you've got the other camp will also sort of accuse the Islamists disingenuously, I think, of being an American puppet and being a Masonic organization or otherwise serving, you know, foreign interests in some way or another. Needless to say, I mean, I find that hard to believe, especially in light of everything that's happened in the last 7 weeks. And it definitely looks like at the end of the day, the U.S. is standing behind the military, would much rather just see a Mubarak style military regime in Egypt controlling things, just as it did, just as Mubarak did for them for 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we remember
right,
too,
right.
When the Arab Spring broke out in Egypt back at the beginning of 2011, they did everything they could to keep Mubarak in power. And then when the game was up and they had no choice whatsoever, they said, well, you think we could maybe settle for Omar Suleiman, the head of the secret torture police? He's done such a good job on our extraordinary rendition program. Let's keep him. There's no question about what the Americans have wanted here. They pretended to celebrate democracy there, but they've been working to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood ever since then, correct?
Yeah. And I think everything that's happened in the last since Morsi's overthrow, I think really, really sort of cements that, or at least, you know, certainly supports that that assertion. That the Brotherhood, whereas it might have been co-opted in some, you know, in some regard, in some way, it might have been co-opted. It might have had bad elements in it. I think, generally speaking, overall, it did represent an independent Egyptian force.
Right.
You know, and
it made sense, Adam, that the CIA would back the Muslim Brotherhood when the opposition were the anti-American nationalists or the socialists back during. The Cold War, the Nasserites and whatever. But once they got Sadat and then Mubarak, why in the world would they support the Brotherhood? They had the military dictatorship.
Right. That's a good point. Just because if there was cooperation between the Brotherhood and the U.S. at some point in the past doesn't necessarily mean that that's still the case. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, that was back before Sadat, I think. And then, of course, now after they realized that they couldn't have Omar Suleiman, the head of the secret torture police, and that there were going to be elections, then, of course, it makes sense that they would try to, you know, work with the Brotherhood if they could and place bets on all sides if they can. But that doesn't mean that the Brotherhood were their choice.
Listen, I think what happened was all along as they were reassuring the Brotherhood, because I was quite impressed at some of the things they said about the Brotherhood. Just a month before Morsi's overthrow, there was an interview with the American ambassador here, and they, you know, the U.S. line was consistently like, look, these guys won fair elections, so we're going to deal with them as the legitimate rulers here. And people would even, you know, you'd even have people asking them about, oh, well, what about the Salafist Noor party, and you know, and the Americans would be like, look, this is a party, and this is like the ultra ortho, you know, super hardcore Islamists, far, far more hardcore than the Muslim Brotherhood. And the American response was like, these guys won 25% of parliamentary seats in the last free parliamentary elections, so, I mean, we deal with them as we would any other legitimate legal political party. But that being said, I think all along, I think the idea was, I don't know if you remember this, it was just about 1 year ago, maybe a year and a month ago, when they had the elections, there was a week-long period before they announced the final results. And it was really, the whole country was on pins and needles because nobody knew what was happening at the highest of levels. It was obvious, like, there was some kind of arguments going on. There was wheeling and dealing going on. There was no reason why the election results should have been delayed this long. It went on for about 5 days, 6 days. And finally, they announced that Mohamed Morsi had won by a slim margin, by 51%. Now, I think the idea all along was, as shocked and horrified as the Mubarak era elements and even the neoconservative elements in the United States, as shocked as they were, I think the idea was all along, he won the elections and we can't cover that up because too many people are watching. The whole world is watching. And plus the Muslim Brotherhood itself had people stationed in all of the polling stations to double check its own numbers, which all turned out to be accurate.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to steal an election, it's got to be kind of close. You can't just steal 15 points or 10 points or something, you know?
Right. I think they couldn't steal it. So basically they said, look, we can't steal it. And, you know, we're not sort of prepared to steal it or whatever. Too many eyes are on us. Let him become president and let's start a plan from today, basically. Let's do everything we can to undermine him from here on out, from the moment he takes office. And let's plan to get him out within 1 year. This guy's not going to, we're going to make sure this guy doesn't stay for 1 year. And then it's exactly what they did. The Mubarak era media, even the private media, which is all owned by Mubarak friends and associates, immediately launched a smear campaign that just did not stop, 24/7 anti-Morsi, anti-Brotherhood. Lots and lots of accusations that were never unfounded accusations against the group, lots of straight up lies. You had a judiciary that was all, if not appointed by Mubarak, at least approved by Mubarak. And they all remain in place. And they were adamant, they were rabidly anti-Morsi as well. They did everything they could to trip up any sort of legislation he tried to do. They tried to, and they also let go, they also exonerated loads and loads of Mubarak era officials. They let that, you know, in the cases, all those guys were freed. I mean, it was incredible. Morsi tried to move against the judiciary, but he didn't get any support on the street, unfortunately. And everybody branded what he was doing as a power grab and all of this sort of thing when he was actually just trying to make a move against the judiciary. And the police police remains completely intact, interior ministry. He made some changes as well, but apparently from what I heard, within hours of his overthrow, all of those changes that he made to the interior ministry were reversed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of old people started coming back again. We've also had apparently this new government is full of Mubarak era officials. I can't give you an exact number. They were all just announced like a week ago or 2 weeks ago. But that they're stocked with Mubarak era holdovers. Also a big raft of governors, provincial governor appointments was made a couple days ago or a week ago. And, that's almost entirely, virtually all the governors are of military background as well. So, yeah, it's basically what we've seen now since July 3rd and everything that's happened in its wake. I mean, it's basically the undoing of the January 25th revolution. It's a counter-revolution. Yeah. I mean, I think at this stage it's safe to say it's become clear to everybody that what's happened is a counter-revolution. And if you notice, Mohamed Bouradei just resigned yesterday.
Right.
The whole Bouradei thing is just sort of like, I see him sort of as a microcosm for the whole liberal left of this thing. They joined the putsch against Morsi, and then when Morsi was out and they had served their purpose,
uh-huh,
they themselves became entirely marginalized.
Yeah, big surprise. They really blew it there, man. They should have just...
Oh, big time.
Yeah,
big
it time. Sucks to lose an election sometimes, but, oh, you prefer a military dictatorship? That'll make sure you never lose any more elections, you idiots.
Yeah, it was extreme. I've never seen such incredible short-sightedness to the point where I have to ask myself, I mean, can anybody be that stupid? Or are you somehow involved? Like the Brotherhood say, are you part of a broader conspiracy from the very beginning, and you were all just pretending to be liberals and Democrats?
Mm. Well, and you know... And I'm sure it's kind of a mix of both. And this is part of the problem of being Egypt or being Syria or any other small country, relatively small country. I know Egypt is the most important Arab state, but still, you get stuck between a lot of power plays by outside powers. I mean, America is the 800,000-ton gorilla here that rules the whole planet Earth, and it doesn't mean that they always get whatever they want, but it does mean that they're up to their eyeballs in everything. And so... When you take one side or the other, you are taking one side or the other in an American conflict, too. You can't help it, right? Same thing in Syria right now. You got decent people who want to kill Assad for good reasons. How dare he be the dictator of their country? He's got no right to be their dictator, but they can't overthrow him without doing Benjamin Netanyahu's dirty work. So what are you going to do, you know?
Right. Another thing this has shown also is just Egypt's incredible geostrategic importance as well. I remember saying in the middle of the 18 days in 2 years ago, the revolution 2 years ago, that would no matter what happened in Egypt, you know, like even if Egypt did get rid of Mubarak and had elections, da, 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 that the powers that be, you know, in Washington or wherever, would never allow it to go its own way, you know, would absolutely never allow it to just do what it wanted to. It's just too important, you know,
in terms of its size,
its population, its strategic location, the Suez Canal, its proximity to Israel, all these other things.
Right. Well, yeah, and, you know, Israel has a hell of a lot to do with this, what they want. And I think it's pretty clear that they're scared to death of anything with the name Muslim anything in it.
And especially, again, in Egypt, you're talking about an 80 million plus population. You're not talking about a neighbor like Jordan, which has 5 million people or 6 million people, or Tunis that has something like 10 million or something like that. I mean, Egypt is 80. It's by far the largest Arab country in terms of population, 80 million. And it's right, man. It shares an enormous border with Israel.
All right. Now, real quick here, because we're almost out of time, Adam, let me just mention a couple of things for your remarks. One is John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has said, oh, this wasn't a coup. This is just, you know, reinstalling democracy, which seemed to be, if not a green light to go ahead and mask her, it at least said, we're not going to do anything about it if you do. I mean, the news reports are that Chuck Hagel tried to talk him out of it, but why would they bother when they know the Americans aren't going to cut aid no matter what, that the Americans are going to back them? And then the second thing I wanted you to remark upon, please, would be whether this really could descend into an Algeria-style civil war type situation, because isn't it the case that the Muslim Brotherhood, they just don't have any guns of their own? They can protest all damn day, but they don't have the ability to really fight back, do they?
Right. To start, answer the first question very quickly. The position of the U.S. on this, to be quite honest with you, has confused me. I mean, you just had two Republican senators here about a week ago, maybe less, McCain and Graham. And both of them came out basically saying that it was a military coup and sort of like slapping the Egyptians on the wrists for like, you know, they said, look, the people that were elected are now in jail. And the people who are now running the country are unelected. And I don't know what the purpose of that was. And to the point where Obama, I think the White House even issued a statement saying, look, these guys are not speaking on our behalf. It was all very weird. And I quite frankly, I wasn't able to follow it as closely as I wanted to because so many other things were happening here. So the position of the United States is weird. It's obvious that there's like major, some kind of major division going on in the states, that this is obviously causing major divisions, at the highest levels in the states. Between who and who, I'm not enough of an expert on U.S. policy to be able to tell exactly where the division lies. I mean, I'm quite frankly focused too closely on domestic events in Egypt right now. But that's, the U.S. does not have a monolithic stance on Egypt, and there's obviously still something going on behind closed doors, arguments going on behind closed doors whether or not to call it a military coup. So I don't know whether that fight is between the White House and Congress or somewhere else.
It may even be inside the administration.
It might be inside the administration itself. I don't know.
And then real quick about the Brotherhood's ability to really resist.
Unknown. It's unknown. But look, we could see a situation within 6 months' time or another year or even who knows, even less. Where you start having, because the regional situation is getting so choppy now, you could have a situation where you've got foreign fighters and foreign jihadists coming from Libya and Syria into Egypt to help the Brotherhood and the Islamists fight the military here. Who knows?
All right. Thanks, Adam. I sure appreciate it.
Sure, Scott. Until next time.
See ya.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. Hey, all, Scott here. I think you ought to consider subscribing to The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation, in print or online. The Future of Freedom features the best writers in the libertarian movement, the fearless Jacob Hornberger, individualist anarchist Sheldon Richman, and crusading journalist Jim Bovard, along with Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Tim Kelly, Richard Ebling, and many more. And the July issue features one by your favorite radio host on America's Middle East policy, entitled Stupidity or the Plan. So head on over to fff.org/subscribe and sign up for The Future of Freedom in print or online. That's fff.org/subscribe and tell them Scott sent you. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first, and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.